Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to A Voyage to Antarctica. I'm Alok Jha. We hear plenty about the glories of men like Scott and Shackleton, who lived in and explored Antarctica. But what about the women? This week I'm speaking to Sarah Wheeler and Camilla Nicol. Sarah was the US National Science Foundation's first female writer in residence at the South Pole. She spent 7 months in Antarctica. From there, she wrote international bestseller Terra Incognita. She also wrote Cherry, a life of Apsley Cherry Garrard, who was one of the youngest members of Captain Scott's final expedition to the Antarctic. Camilla is chief executive of the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust. She is a geologist and has worked in the museums and heritage sector for more than 20 years. She's held positions at the Leeds Museums and Galleries and York Museums Trust. When she was working for the Hunterian Museum at Glasgow University, she helped uncover a collection of Antarctic rocks collected by James Wordy on Elephant Island. Camilla is a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society. Camilla, who were the first women on Antarctica? Do we know?
Yeah, well, we do, kind of, yes. There's anecdotal evidence of some very early women reaching sort of Antarctic waters, possibly sort of indigenous Maori New Zealanders visiting on boats into the Antarctic Ocean. But so hard evidence of the earliest woman in Antarctica didn't come to light really until 1985, when a skull was found on a beach on one of the South Shetland Islands. And it turned out, after analysis, turned out to be a young indigenous woman from Chile, so probably deriving from the southernmost parts of Chile, in the Beagle Channel area, and was dated to have died between 1819 and 1825. So this is the actual moment that Antarctica was discovered 200 years ago. But we don't know any more than that about her story, really. But there's a presumption that she was probably part of a sealer's expedition, accompanying her husband, probably, on the ship. But we do know that... these are the ships that were visiting at that time, and she was probably the first woman sort of recorded, really, to have visited Antarctica.
And unfortunately, it seems died there too.
Indeed, yes. Well, these are harsh conditions. Certainly, the analysis does point to some of the causes of her death, malnutrition and injuries as well. So, certainly not a happy ending to her story. She was aged to about 21 years of age. But in terms of the first kind of recorded woman to set foot in Antarctica for sure, that we now have actual records of, was a Danish explorer called Caroline Mikkelsen in 1935. And she accompanied her husband on an expedition to find islands that Norway could claim ownership of during the sort of peak of the whaling industry. And she was the first recorded woman to set foot in Antarctica at that early time.
So it seems like the women were there from the early years, but why was Antarctica known as the womanless continent for so long in the 20th century? I mean, is that a fair assessment of how it was seen?
Yeah, I think There probably is. I mean, the record of female sort of activity in Antarctica between the 1820s and the 1930s doesn't reflect much in the way of female exploration or expeditioners, but it's likely that women formed part of the crews of ships sailing to the Antarctic, accompanying their husbands generally. But as history often shows, you know, the evidence of women's activity anywhere just isn't documented, and so they remain what are known as whalers' wives, which is rather diminutive, really. But you know, as the 20th century progressed into the heroic era of exploration and into the scientific era later on, Antarctica was viewed for a long time as a place for men. The environment, the climate and the facilities, of course, were just too harsh for women. And women are far too sensitive, really, for such a difficult place. And I think this sort of is paralleled, I think, probably at the same time with the arguments against women in the military. I think they're too weak to cope in a crisis. There's a likelihood of catfights, obviously. And of course, they're irresistible. There is irresistible charms and they're distracting allure to men in the field. So the women were sort of heavily discouraged from being in Antarctica.
There was a famous episode, famous now, when a scientist had applied, a female scientist had applied to go, and the authorities wrote back sort of saying, well, it's not really suitable, and trying to think of a lot of different ways of saying that. And they said, well, women wouldn't be comfortable in the Antarctic because there are no shops and hairdressers. And that was deemed to be enough of a reason to keep pesky women out.
The women who did start going in the 20th century, what did they go as first? You mentioned whalers' wives, which is not a very sort of fair term. But then also people were going in the 20th century. Did they go as explorers first? Did they go as scientists? What was the sort of development of that?
Yeah, both really. I mean, certainly I would say probably scientists first, to be honest. I think it took a long time for women to be allowed. I mean, they spent an awful lot of time sort of working supporting roles back at home. So maybe in the UK, at the equivalent of the British Antarctic Survey's offices, for example, working as scientists and doing the science, but not being allowed to get onto the ice. And they even worked in the ships. They were allowed to do science from the ships, but not allowed necessarily to get onto the ice. But it wasn't until slightly later, really, that women started to penetrate, I suppose, into the Antarctic. I mean, early on, we know women were included in expeditions as they accompanied their husbands. There were some early pioneers in exploration and science. And in the 50s and 60s, we started to see more and more women making their mark. I mean, they were even taking leadership roles and decision-making roles in science and in support of Antarctic research back home. So there was certainly a female presence. It's just they weren't allowed on the stations. So there was a considerable resistance to women being there, and it was a certain environment that was difficult for women to be. I think that there is a case to support the idea that women were kept out of this men's club. The Antarctic was seen as a place for men, as a place to, you know, for men to be and to conquer. And it was uncomfortable for women to be in terms of the conditions that were set up there. So, you know, put it this way, I suppose there was perhaps a more of a locker room culture on some of the bases right up until the 80s and 90s. And certainly, you know, I was graduating in the early 90s and I was looking at careers as a geologist. And there was certainly something off-putting about working for women working in the Antarctic even then. So it has always been a difficult place, but women have, as in all areas of life, have persisted and crashed through those glass or ice ceilings. But now we see, you know, great accomplishments in science and in leadership, but also in exploration, and some wonderful accomplishments in Antarctic exploration by women.
Are there any stories of women in Antarctica that stand out for you as sort of battling against these odds that you've outlined so eloquently?
Well, I think there's some interesting, you know, there's loads of interesting stories, but I think one of my favourite ones, which kind of touched one of the historic sites that we look after, was the story of Jackie Ronnie and Jenny Darlington, who accompanied their husbands on the Finn Ronnie expedition 1946-48. And they were they sailed down on the ship down through Chile, and they were just going to accompany their husbands to Valparaiso or maybe Punta Arenas and then wave them off. But they were persuaded when they got to Valparaiso to, oh, why don't you just stay in. Let's come. Why don't you come? Jenny Darlington and Harry Darlington were newlyweds, so didn't particularly want to be apart for 2 years, I think. And they were persuaded, and it necessitated a little shopping trip to get a warmer nightie and a pair of boots, obviously. But they persisted, and they went down to Stonington Island. They stayed at East Base over winter, and they became the first women to overwinter in Antarctica. And this was in 1947, so very early. It was a last-minute decision. And a number of the other members of the crew were not happy, and they did actually put together a petition to say that the women shouldn't come. But they did go. And they both wrote books afterwards. And they are a terrific read. But their experience was coloured not only by being women in this very difficult place to live, very male place, very difficult environmental and climatic circumstances, but also the kind of personal interactions, how the people got along. And actually there were terrible fallings out. There was a great rift in the team amongst the men in the team, as well as between the women. And actually Jenny Darlington became pregnant, which also added to the tension, I think, whilst they were there. But their accounts are extraordinary. And I think just looking at kind of the human condition, I think, and how humans and people can survive in difficult situations and how they cope is a really interesting story. So I'd recommend their books very, very highly. But I think on their return, I mean, Jenny Darlington certainly didn't recommend Antarctica to women in the future, saying women just don't belong in Antarctica. But I think I think that has been disproven over and over ever since.
When you were there, what was the mix of men and women like? I'm assuming it wasn't equal, but what were you seeing?
America was quite evolved, not quite as evolved as Russia at that time in terms of women on the job, but lots of women. It was maybe 35% women in America, and it would be 50% on the Russian basis. And maybe it would have been 25% in the Italian and Eastern European countries who were there. Pretty good. So what doesn't feel like an endangered species? The British came a bit later to the party, and there was very few. When I say very few, when I arrived, there were none. And that has now changed.
Yeah, I think it's certainly much, much better than it has been. I mean, women have been kind of really heavily and actively involved in Antarctica, I think most significantly now, for the last 20 years. And we're looking at a much, much more equal ratio of men to women in working in Antarctica. And they're working in roles in science, in exploration, in field support, in tourism, in governance, in heritage, in my field, and also environmental campaigning. So you're seeing, a greater breadth of human activity in Antarctica, but also many, many more women there. Bases are now set up, of course, for both genders. So it's, you know, it is an easier, much, much easier place to live and work than it might have been in 1947 for Jenny and Jackie. But there's still more to do, and I think there's a lot more to do with diversity generally in Antarctica, and there's lots of talk about that and a lot of organisations pushing to improve diversity generally. But you're seeing female leadership, you're seeing some incredible accomplishments by women in science and in climate science and in exploration. So it is and they're doing this visibly, so it is great to see.
The crucial thing is that girls and young women going through the education system, if they're interested in a particular branch of the science, they are going to see role models. And I think that's what's important. I mean, female role models in their field.
I mean, you talk about leadership. I mean, you're obviously the chief executive of the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust. And for this podcast series, we've also spoken to Professor Dame Jane Francis, who's director of the British Antarctic Survey. So evidently, female leadership is now very much on the continent. Has that changed anything?
I think it has. I think Dame Jane particularly is a huge role model. She's a role model for me when I was a student. So I think seeing women in leadership roles in Antarctica is incredibly inspiring for a lot of people. I think there are many more women now reaching for the polar regions in general for their careers, whether it's in science or field sport, tourism, heritage. And I think female leadership offers those role models, offers visibility and the ability for, you know, women to do whatever they want, you know, with their careers. And as with any sector, the involvement of women in leadership brings, you know, huge benefits, certainly stability, sort of more balanced decision making, for broader reaching and impactful decision making, and wider inclusivity. So I think where you see benefits in female leadership in business, you see it in Antarctica. I think even more so in Antarctica, because you're seeing a place that international eyes are looking at Antarctica. So, you know, everybody, all nations have all Antarctic treaty nations have a stake in the future success of Antarctica. So seeing female leadership around, for example, the Antarctic Treaty table is incredibly important. And it's a beacon for how, you know, international collaborations can work elsewhere.
What was it like the first time you went to Antarctica? How did you feel? What was it like?
My first trip to Antarctica, it was mind-blowing. I went to the Ross Sea and visited the explorers' huts of Scott and Shackleton as a guest of the New Zealand Antarctic Heritage Trust. And just the experience of camping outside Captain Scott's hut at Cape Evans. You unzip your tent and look at Mount Erebus smoking gently on the horizon, and you turn around and there's this iconic hut. And you're seeing the landscape that Scott saw, you know, 110 years previously. It was just mind-blowing. It was mind-blowing. These are stories, you know, I grew up with. These are, I remember reading the diaries and dreaming of visiting and seeing these places, and having and doing that for real for the first time, you know, 6 years ago, was astonishing and life-changing, really. I can't think of anywhere else I'd rather work, to be honest. And it just has fired me up to do the best we, you know, as a, we possibly can as a trust to play our part in what we do in Antarctica. It was life-changing and gives you a perspective of your place in the planet, I think. It makes you feel quite small, which I think is never a bad thing.
After 7 months there, did you start to feel like it might be home, or at least familiar in some way?
Oh, gosh, yeah, massively. And you start sort of thinking about how alienating it will be. And it was alienating to come back. And I think that's a common experience. To a certain extent, I felt more at home there than I've ever felt anywhere. And that's because, one, I was completely unmoored, as everybody is who goes there, from all the trappings of life, you know, gas bills and all the rest of it. I think that I did feel more at home there than I've ever felt anywhere. And I don't think that's an uncommon experience from what I've read of other people's experiences in the Antarctic, and also colleagues of mine, friends of mine I made on the ice.
Even though there was nothing tethering you to a schedule, to normal things that might make you feel at home wherever you live?
Yeah, I think it's more meaningful, a sense of being at home, being at one with the landscape, when all these other things that are confections of man aren't pinning you down. I think that it's a more meaningful sense of home. It's a sense of being at home on the planet.
We've heard from many people in this podcast series, and we will hear again about the future of Antarctica and how climate change is, you know, altering the landscape, and how the melting ice there is a harbinger for what's to come for the planet. Do we need to be concerned about the future for this continent?
I think we should. Yes, and we should always be concerned. I think there are great initiatives, there are great accomplishments, and you know the international collaboration that there is around the governance of Antarctica and the decision making around Antarctica is incredibly powerful and a model for many other parts of the world, I think. But there's no reason to be complacent. I think climate change and the climate crisis is incredibly difficult. It is real, and it's changing our planet. And I think you know, we need to be making the right decisions for Antarctica and for the rest of the planet in order to preserve it for the future. I think so. Yes, we should be concerned. We should always be thinking actively about how we can do better. So yes, I mean, I think also how Antarctica was used. I mean, the treaty is robust. The environmental protocol is a piece of legislation which does come for review. And so that protection of Antarctica, it should be, you know, considered carefully. It's how, what the future and the next 50 years of Antarctica should be under global governance. These are decisions that are going to be taken by, you know, those children who are sort of 12 to 14 now. It's these kids who are going to be around that table in the future renegotiating the environmental protocol. So it's incumbent on us to inspire that generation to take that responsibility carefully and seriously and make those right choices.
All these problems do exist and the changes are coming. And the scientists you spoke to and many others have been warning us about these things. There seems to be a role then for people like you to go to Antarctica to tell others what it's like and potentially what we're going to lose. Not only from a scientific and environmental point of view, but this, you know, this enormous desert the size of Australia, something that's impossible for humans to comprehend in our busy lives in cities and countries and in normal places. Having something like that on the planet is quite remarkable and awe-inspiring. I think reminding people of that constantly through books and art seems to me to be very important, right?
I think so, certainly. And it's very important that all those books and pieces of art aren't created by men. That'd be a very peculiar thing if we had such a skewed picture. So, yes, I mean, information and the whole point of oddballs like me going down, I think, is that, is to be able to convey information about the continent that's not exclusively written in the language that scientists can understand.
Yeah, I think really important because, I mean, I think, you know, I hate to say it, but, you know, science isn't for everyone and it doesn't turn everybody on. So, but Antarctica does. I mean, you talk to, I mean, I started working in Antarctica 6 years ago and said, oh, what I do for a job. I mean, everybody is interested in Antarctica. So looking at different ways to talk about Antarctica, to talk about the impact we're having on Antarctica and vice versa, to explore Antarctic stories through different eyes and different voices, just brings a richness, brings a diversity, brings more people around the table, I think. And I think that's really important. It's something we're trying to do with Antarctica Insights. What are the reason for this podcast series is about exploring different people's perceptions, perspectives and experiences of Antarctica and what it means to everyone. I mean, Antarctica is incredibly important to us on our planet, and you know, we all know that it matters, but getting different voices, our creative voices, cultural, historical, scientific voices to explore those themes, I think can be incredibly powerful to engage more people. So I think, you know, the more of that the better from my point of view, really.
What do you think, what do you see the role of the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust as in terms of the kind of things you want to raise awareness about for the continent?
Sure. I mean, we're not a scientific organisation, but what we do look after is the heritage. So we can use those incredible stories of human endeavour in Antarctica, scientific accomplishment in the early days. We can bring a long view to the contemporary science. So you might see in the headline stories of the recovery of blue whales in the Southern Ocean, for example, and we can track back that science to the early origins of the discovery investigations in the 1920s, to the, you know, whale studies and early whale studies in the 1960s, 50s and 60s. So we can offer a long view, take that heritage perspective, which can actually engage people in a different way to the maybe the cold hard science, which we are exposed to on a daily basis. So I think inspiring human stories, the human connection of people in Antarctica and their experience can tell an awful lot about Antarctica in a different, in a new perspective, which I think adds to the story. You know, the Antarctica is famous for being the last wilderness, but actually it's a theatre of some extraordinary human endeavour and some extraordinary human stories. So it's our privilege at UKHT to be able to share those and help people explore them to help better understand Antarctica.
Why does Antarctica matter to you?
Antarctica matters to me because it's the only unowned place on the planet and therefore I think a symbol of what could be, what we could aspire to, something for humankind to aspire to. And certainly it's the most beautiful place I've ever been and I sometimes still go there in my dreams.
Antarctica reminds me daily, I think, of how privileged we are as a human race to be custodians of our planet. And over the last few centuries, we've perhaps not acquitted ourselves terribly well, I would say. And at some point, we could have almost lost everything that is unique and special about this place. But, you know, in the 1950s, the international efforts to stop what we were doing, to try and put right the wrongs, to establish good governance and to do our best for this tremendously special place, gives me huge hope for the future. So I think I find Antarctica incredibly inspiring. So if we can harness the idea and the fact of Antarctica to inspire us to take responsibility for our world more generally, then I think there is huge hope for the future. I mean, I think Antarctica is, for most of us, and for me until 6 years ago when I took this job, is an imaginary place. It's a place that you read about, that you dream of, and you only ever dream of seeing for real. And yet it has the power to inspire us to do better, to take responsibility. And I hope, you know, hope that I can, and the UKHT can play some modest part in that.
A Voyage to Antarctica was presented by me, Alok Jha. It was produced by Jessica Norman, with Ben Hewis as digital producer. Music was composed by Alec Hughes. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. A Voyage to Antarctica is part of the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust's Antarctica in Sight programme, celebrating and reflecting on the past 200 years of human endeavour across this fascinating continent. The Antarctica in Sight programme is supported by the Arts Council England, the Garfield Weston Foundation and the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. The UK Antarctic Heritage Trust is the charity championing the public understanding of and engagement with Antarctica. You can find out more at www.ukaht.org. And you can find us on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. And we'd love to hear from you. Please tweet at or message us to tell us why Antarctica matters to you. Next time, I'll be talking to contemporary artists Peter Liversidge, Lucy Auter, and Mark Rees about how Antarctica has inspired them and influenced their work. See you next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.